The cost of waiting is that it'll take us 3 years to catch up. That's not acceptable.
The state goes ahead with a controversial predator control plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 20th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans share their impressions from a trip to the Gulf of Mexico.
For me, what really struck me as a fisherman was the guys who were just stuck on the port.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu.
State wildlife managers announced today they're going ahead with a plan to carry out predator control next month on Unimak Island with or without the blessing of the federal government. The proposal is controversial because the vast majority of the island is part of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. But the State Department of Fish and Game says action is necessary because the caribou population has crashed so severely in recent years. Biologist Bruce Dale says calf survival has fallen to almost zero.
The surprise is the extremely low bull-cow ratio and the extremely low calf survival and recruitment we've seen in these herds. That's what's not normal. And that's what's for whatever reason, is causing us to take action.
The herd is naturally occurring on the island and is an important subsistence resource to the residents of False Pass. In 2002, the population was healthy with about 1,200 animals. It has dwindled to less than 500. Dale says a severe weather event likely weakened the herd and led to an increase in predation by wolves, which are common on the island. Department of Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Pat Valkenburg says the state has been working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the issue since January. Valkenburg says the predator control plan is in the best interest of both governments.
It's their mandate as well as ours. Our mandate is to maintain sustainable populations of animals and maintain a sustained yield harvest. So really, together, our two charges are very similar.
But the Fish and Wildlife Service isn't on board, at least not yet. Spokesman Bruce Wood says an official response will come from Washington, but he says the agency isn't ready to say that predator control is the best option for saving the Unimak caribou herd.
We're in the process of conducting an environmental review that we believe is necessary before any predator control of this sort could take place on the refuge. We have certainly have some disagreements with the state about some aspects of this issue and not all of them. And we hope that we will be able to continue working with them toward a solution.
Woods wasn't able to give details on what those disagreements are. He says predator control programs on national wildlife refuges are very rare, but the state says they need to proceed with the plan this year in order to quickly bring back the caribou population to a level that will allow for a subsistence hunt. Managers want to carry out a targeted predator control plan where no more than 20% of the island's wolves will be killed, and they'll shoot only the animals that are on or near a calf kill during the brief window in June when most of the island's caribou are born. Valkenburg says waiting is not an option.
The cost of waiting is that it'll take us 3 years to catch up. If we wait 1 year, it'll take us 3 years to catch up to get back where we are now. So that means a delay in the possible onset of harvest for an additional 3 years if we wait, and that's not acceptable.
State biologists say the caribou that have survived on the island are healthy, and the population has a good chance of rebounding if predator control is carried out. A group of Alaska natives fighting oil and gas drilling off Alaska's coasts journeyed this week to the Gulf of Mexico. There, they witnessed firsthand evidence of the oil spill from last month's rig explosion. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, they're now in Washington, D.C. to share what they saw with the federal agencies that make decisions about offshore drilling.
The group was already completely opposed to offshore development in Alaska, but the trip down to the Gulf of Mexico was like seeing their worst fears realized. Rosemary Atungaruk is a Inupiaq and lives in Barrow. She remembers the Exxon Valdez oil spill 21 years ago and says while she dreaded the trip to the Gulf, she needed to see what's happening there. Atungaruk says what she experienced will stay with her.
It's devastating. It's a strong burden that I'll carry with me for the rest of my life. It brought tears to my eyes as we landed on the shores to start the boat ride, for the fumes of the spill were permeating the air. It got into our clothes, into your nose, into our hair. As we traveled out into the water, it increased and concentrated, and yet the people living down there have no escape. The natural smell of the ocean was non-existent.
Atungaruk and the others flew to New Orleans Monday and toured the Gulf by seaplane and boat. The local tribe, the United Houma Nation of Louisiana, welcomed them, and environmental groups paid for their trip. Fellow Barrow resident Martha Falk with the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope says right away she could see the effects.
And while we were out there, I observed rock barriers that had oil on them and shorebirds that were walking all over on these rocks. So there's wildlife that's already been impacted also.
Earl Kingick, an elder from the native village of Point Hope, says he feels like he witnessed what the oil companies and the federal government pledged wouldn't happen, a blowout and an uncontrollable spill.
I put crude in my hand, smelled it. Oh, it's terrible, terrible smell. I tried washing it off with water. It wouldn't even wash off. I could just feel how the migratory birds, when they get coated with oil, how they feel. The sticky crude that was in my hand couldn't be washed out just by water. I tried with paper towel. It didn't work. So I used gravel, and the gravel helped me a little bit. And the smell of my hand couldn't go away for many hours. And I feel real sad about the animals that got oil on them right now.
Kingick and his fellow traveler, Werner Wilson, say he reached down to touch the crude 45 miles away from the spill site. They say sludge had gotten past booms and seeped into the grasses and beach. Wilson is Central Siberian Yupik and comes from a fishing tradition in Dillingham.
For me, what really, really struck me as a fisherman was the guys who were just stuck on the port, and they were saying how, you know, they couldn't go fishing for the past few weeks because it was shut down. And then hearing the our guide saying that fishermen told him that a lot of people were wondering about the seafood catch and maybe not wanting to eat it because of the pollution. And that really should be concerned to every fisherman, especially in Alaska. If there's ever to be an accident, it's all about perception. It's all about, you know, the price of our fish. So that was heartbreaking for me.
Wilson says it rang home for him because his father was a plaintiff in the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Finally, last year, he finally got a $66 check. And when I told that to the Mobile stakeholders, they were taken aback and they gasped and they were stunned in disbelief.
Rosemary Atungaruk says Gulf Coast residents may just be starting to experience what Alaskans lived through 21 years ago.
I was watching one of the lifts taking boats out of the marina and putting them in a warehouse. People didn't want their boats in the water, risking contamination of their boat and their gear. I had one fisherman say to me, "I wish this spill happened before Katrina. I would have left because now I've already started to rebuild." But rebuild with what future? My lifestyle is being erased hour by hour, gallon by gallon.
The four Alaskans are visiting the federal agencies in Washington that make decisions about offshore development. Soon, they'll head home with new dedication to fight oil and gas drilling in their backyards. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
An ice-free Arctic may be closer than originally thought. The latest satellite images show the ice cover over the Arctic Ocean is now where it was at the end of the summer 2 years ago. The National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, says it could be a record year for ice loss. But as the CBC's Leonard Linkletter reports, it all depends on the weather.
Mark Serez is director of the Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. He was surprised to see the latest satellite images.
Right now, we're very close to where we were at this same time of year for 2007. And 2007, as you remember, was the record low in ice extent we ever had. And we're talking about the ice extent at the end of the melt season in September.
Serez won't say this will be a record year for ice loss. He says that depends on whether we have a hot or cold summer. But he does agree with other scientists that something needs to be done. The National Academy of Sciences is calling for carbon taxes and cap-and-trade systems. Serez says people should also get ready for a world without Arctic sea ice in the summer.
And eventually you're going to have a blue Arctic Ocean in summer. You could sail right from Point Barrow all the way to Halifax if you wanted to.
As for when that will be, Serez says he's sticking with their prediction that it will happen by 2030, give or take 5 years, depending on the weather. Leonard Linkletter, Whitehorse.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the benefits of some very basic infrastructure in rural Alaska.
With water and sewer here in Chivac, we've been blessed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com.
A change in the weather is helping slow progress of wildfires south of Fairbanks. Today's cool, wet, calmer conditions followed several days of hot, windy weather that saw four wildfires flare up from remnants of 2009 blazes. Three of the fires in the Wood River region are in limited management zones and being allowed to burn, while the fourth is being fought. The Toklat Fire, 25 miles south-southwest of Nenana, is threatening native allotments and cabins in the Kantishna River area. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Doug Stockdale says suppression efforts were upped as the fires grew substantially today.
It made some big runs and probably grew, it went about 7 miles in about 7 hours. It's burning just east of East Twin Lake right now. We have at least two crews on it, a number of smoke jumpers. We've put retardant on it, and we may have other crews going down there to provide structure protection. There are some cabins that are in the area and threatened, and we are watching that one very closely.
Stockdale says this past winter's low snowpack has allowed fuels to dry out, and ground conditions are more like June and July. The world's largest zinc mine will proceed with its expansion. Teck Resources made the announcement this morning that they will go to work developing another deposit at the Red Dog Mine near Kivalina. They had been suggesting they might not proceed this year because of a holdup in awarding their water quality permit. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Along with being the biggest in the world, the Red Dog Mine is the main employer in the Kotzebue region. 550 people work there, a large number of them shareholders of Nana Regional Native Corporation, Teck's partner in the mine and the owner of the ore deposit. The present ore body is nearly exhausted, but there's another one that could be mined, continuously if they get to work preparing it this year. Otherwise, the company said, there could be layoffs. But people downstream accused the mine of polluting, and in fact, in a legal settlement, it admitted it had been exceeding the terms of its water quality permit repeatedly and bought water filters for people who use the creek. When Red Dog got a state permit for the expanded mine that would allow the dissolved solids to be measured some distance downstream from where the water flowed out of the mine's treatment plant, the downstream residents appealed the permit to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. They're still waiting for the results of that appeal, but something has given Teck enough confidence now that it's willing to announce there will be no shutdown. Lance Miller, NANA's vice president for resources, says the new section of the mine would be able to meet the terms of the permit they got prior to the appeal, and that expectation guided Teck's decision to proceed.
There are permit conditions that have been put forward by EPA, but at the present time, they have been withdrawn. So those permit limits, though, that have been based on the SCIS, on the sound science, the mine could operate within.
So far, there's no word of a settlement with those who appealed the permits. Those plaintiffs include some regional residents and a legal firm that represents the underprivileged. The earlier settlement involved legal fees, but no damages for the residents. There's been talk of a pipeline to divert the mine's outflow, though Teck and NANA contend the water coming out of the treatment plant is cleaner than the water in the stream it's being dumped into. When pressed to say what exactly had changed that persuaded the company to go ahead with its plans while the permit appeal is still pending, a Teck spokesman said they now have a clearer idea of what the EPA wants, even though negotiations are still not complete. When EPA chose to get involved again, it raised red flags in state government, prompting a protest from Governor Sean Parnell. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Yesterday, reporter Len Anderson described the Western Alaska village of Kasigluk as it prepares to abandon its honey buckets for a community water and sewer system. From Kasigluk, Anderson went to Chivek, which has had its water and sewer hookups for 10 years and provides a good example of the benefits and challenges a village system offers.
To paraphrase British social and art critic John Ruskin, a good sewer now enjoys more appreciation than a fine painting. As far as Greg Slatz of Chivek is concerned, Ruskin's 19th century observation still rings loud and true.
With water and sewer here in Chivek, we've been blessed.
Slatz is a lifelong resident of Chivek. For him, the system brought more than convenience. It means better health for his children.
Before water and sewer came, my older children, we used to have a lot of health problems. You know, we'd have to go in and then get them checked for RSV and stuff like that.
Slatz says his children, 8 years and younger, haven't had the RSV incidents his older ones experienced, including expensive emergency trips to Bethel. RSV stands for Respiratory Syncytial Virus. Troy Ritter is a senior environmental health consultant with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. In 2008, Ritter was part of a team who published a landmark study on the relationship between in-house water service and village health.
Villages that have higher rates of water service have about 3.5 times fewer respiratory infections, such as RSV or pneumonia. We also see much lower rates of skin infections, about 4 times fewer skin infections, and also a group of disease that's called invasive pneumococcal disease. Those are also about 3.5 times less in villages that have water service compared to those who don't.
Ritter says subsequent studies continue to support and expand upon the original findings. The consortium's John Nichols deals with the health of the system itself. Nichols is the statewide manager of the Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, a consortium agency designed to make certain village water and sewer systems keep flowing, both physically and financially. Nichols says the collaborative offers 2 service levels.
For a very small fee, we will bill the customers for the community, send all the bills from Anchorage, charge what the village tells us to charge for each customer. And then at the end of the month, we will turn around and give that money back to the community along with the accounting so they know who's paid and who hasn't paid, and give that money back to them so they can operate their own water sewer system.
15 villages currently use the billing assistance program, but more are in the process of joining, especially in the NANA region.
The Northwest Arctic Borough, for example, is a real supporter of the billing assistance and ARUC programs. And so the Northwest Arctic Borough will actually pay $300 of that $350 a month of that service.
Full collaborative membership means not only billing assistance, but ARUC will manage and operate the water and sewer system with local labor.
We hire the water plant operators. We ensure that we always have a backup operator in each community. In fact, we'll often have two backup operators in communities. We ensure that we send our water plant operators to training so they can further their skills. We pay the operators well, and we give them paid time off, and we give them a retirement plan.
Besides a low employee turnover rate, Nichols says a village like Chivac enjoys another benefit from membership. Well-performed maintenance can lengthen the designed 20-year system lifespan by 10 to 20 years. It's a sunny if breezy breakup day in Chivac. Spring is in the air. Larry Nochtuk stands in the entry of the R Cash store. The store sits along a slope descending to the former Honey Bucket Pond.
Our lagoon was right on bottom of the hill. It was easily seen by most of the villagers.
What would have been like here, say, 12 years ago, standing right here with the wind coming off the lagoon?
It would be quite a horrific smell. And almost no matter where you walked, you'd smell it.
Chivac City Administrator and ARUC Village Advisory Member Dennis Jones says the last 10 years with water and sewer have changed residents' lives.
Getting a system like that, you know, it spoils you, I guess, if that's the word, but there's just no way that anybody here in town would feel comfortable going back unless something happens.
ARUC's Nichols immediately spoke up. That's our job, he said, to make sure none of our villages ever has to go back. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Some Sea Alaska shareholders are pushing for a change in corporate decision-making. They say the current discretionary voting system favors board incumbents and slows change. Managers of the Southeast Regional Native Corporation say the current system works well. Coastal Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Sea Alaska shareholders are in the process of electing four members of the corporation's board of directors. They can choose among a dozen candidates. Four are board-endorsed incumbents, and eight are independents. But close to 30% of voting shareholders will leave that choice up to the board. They'll do that by checking the discretionary box on Sea Alaska's proxy statement ballot.
I don't think discretionary works at all. It keeps that small group in there controlling everything.
Mick Beasley is a Sea Alaska shareholder who's running for the board as an independent. He's authored a resolution, also on the corporate ballot, to change the system.
If we are able to limit discretionary voting, it'll be like putting a circulating pump in our election process, and we'll be getting different directors, different ideas, and we need that.
All of our shareholders can vote for every candidate that they choose.
Nicole Hollingstad is Sea Alaska's corporate secretary and vice president of human resources.
If an independent nominee has the support of shareholders and receives enough directed votes, they do get elected to the board, as was exactly the case with Barbara Cadiente Nelson in 2009.
But Cadiente Nelson was the first independent candidate elected in years. Almost all new members are appointed when others step down during their terms. That allows them to run as incumbents. One of this year's independent candidates is Richard Reinhart Jr., formerly Sea Alaska's chief financial officer. He says discretionary voting is just one of the barriers to getting on the board.
Sea Alaska has community meetings that the directors are able to go to all those places and meet all those people. So that's hard to compete with. And then all of the directors pull together. So really, you're not running just against the four that are up for re-election. You're really running against the 13, and even those that are not up for re-election are out campaigning for those that are.
Sea Alaska shareholders have voted four times to keep discretionary voting, but it's been 13 years since the system was on the corporate ballot, and several thousand people have since won the right to vote. Existing board members say many people depend on the discretionary system.
The shareholder may be saying that I don't know all of the candidates, but I do have confidence in the board, and so therefore I would prefer that you allocate my vote for me.
Rosita Worrell has been on Sea Alaska's board for 23 years. She serves as its vice chair.
I myself came on as an independent, and I came on where I ran, you know, a group of people chose, you know, to run that way, and we were able to use discretionary votes among ourselves. So it was helpful for us.
The most recent board member to be appointed is Bill Thomas, who also serves in the state legislature. He says he changed his mind about discretionary voting after attending community shareholder meetings.
Most of the people that spoke in support of discretionary voting said it was a vote of support of the board of directors. And I never looked at it that way. I always thought that it was a way that they would manipulate the vote and all. And people just, they were upset that the people would say that they didn't know how to vote.
The measure on Sea Alaska's proxy ballot would get rid of board-sponsored discretionary slates, unless a shareholders group also assembles its own slate. Then both could run a group of candidates. The corporation says that would make elections extremely difficult. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The H1N1 flu is still present in the U.S., although Alaska has not seen a laboratory-confirmed case since early April. Dr. Joe McLaughlin, the state's chief epidemiologist, says it's still possible to get it this summer, and it will likely be predominant running through the normal flu season beginning this fall.
We are still recommending that anybody who hasn't been vaccinated against H1N1 yet this year to go ahead and get vaccinated. One of the things that was very unusual last year is that this virus emerged in the spring, and we actually had cases that continued to occur during the summer. So we just don't know when the H1N1 strain will sort of reemerge and we'll start to see a resurgence of cases.
The swine flu last year caused 13 deaths in Alaska, which Dr. McLaughlin calls low based on national estimates. He says those who get protection against the regular flu this year will also get swine flu protection. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Leonard Linkletter in Canada, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web, www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.